Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and on this podcast, I speak with founders, investors, and domain experts from the Indian Valley, trying to understand the art of building a legendary company. In this episode, I speak with Ankit Mehrotra, co-founder and CEO of Dineout. Dineout is one of the pioneers of the Indian restaurant industry, having digitized multiple aspects of the value chain, uncovering massive restaurant footprint and value add. Ankit, along with his co-founders, have gone through a very interesting decade-long journey to build out Dineout. In 10-plus years, they have added multiple companies to their business suite, expanded product offering on both the B2C and the B2B sides, fought the COVID wave, and finally gotten acquired by Swiggy recently. The next 60 minutes is an absolute masterclass for anyone fascinated by the restaurant industry. Ankit shares the entire story of Dineout, including the early days, the ups and downs, and the eventual acquisition. We also discuss what it means to run a restaurant and understand the components required to scale it. And finally, we decode how Dineout managed inorganic growth, both as an acquirer and an acquired organization, alongside many other very interesting business lessons. A $200 million exit after 10 years of business brilliance. This episode is a true testament to the building journey and what happens in the background. Stick around for the entire episode and I can assure you, incredible insights. Before we get started, here is a very quick word about our sponsor. This episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast is presented by Stride Ventures, which is one of India's leading venture debt funds, becoming synonymous with innovative startup financing in India. Stride Ventures provides comprehensive solutions going beyond venture debt to cater to distinctive challenges faced by high growth and inherently strong businesses backed by leading institutions. The fund has a portfolio of over 60 plus diversified companies, having deployed more than 1,500 crore rupees to date. In just over 2 years, Stride Ventures has emerged as the preferred venture debt lender in the Indian ecosystem. To know more about this phenomenal fund, visit strideventures.in, that is spelled as STRIDEVENTURES.IN. And with that, let's dive in to the 127th episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast with Ankit Mehrotra of Dineout. Thank you so much, Ankit, for joining me. Incredibly delighted to be hosting you today.
Hi, Jara. Thanks a lot for having me over. I know this has been pending for a while, so glad to, you know, finally be talking to you about.
Absolutely. The pleasure is all mine. And I think the longer we wait, the better it is, I guess. So looking forward to the next 45 odd minutes with you, Ankit. But it's very interesting, the Dineout journey, because I think you've seen the evolution of the Indian restaurant tech business from the very start. You've played a very important role in making it what it is as well. And I want to uncover much of that decade plus long journey with you. But before we get going, I think it'll be good to revisit the beginning. How do you, as a finance enthusiast, come together with a group of very different individuals and start in the restaurant business, that too at a time where it was not very sexy to be in the food tech market and stuff like that. So maybe take us through those days of company building. How did it all come together? What was the initial insight?
No, yeah, absolutely. You've taken me back more than a decade now. You know, it just makes me feel a lot older than I probably want to feel. But yeah, so our journey started, way back in 2010. So I was, as you said, so I was an investment banker in London and I had a very successful career and I had just, you know, I'd survived the entire financial crisis and we had just come out of it. And 2010 was when, you know, things had started picking up again. And incidentally, I'm also a CFA charter holder. So in fact, the day I got my CFA result that I passed level 3 is when I decided to sort of quit my job. And the genesis of that is that in London, I always used to use a platform called Toptable to figure out restaurants. And my co-founder Sahil at that time, he was based in the US and he used to use OpenTable. a lot. But whenever we used to come back to India, we always used to struggle to figure out, you know, which restaurants to go to or which are the new restaurants that have opened up, because no directory as such existed. And we all had to rely always on, you know, either friends or word of mouth. So we always used to wonder that, you know, why doesn't a service like this exist in India? And eventually one day we just got talking and, you know, we realized that, okay, you know, we've had a corporate careers for a good 7 or 8 years. And we said, we felt like now it's the right time to sort of, you know, come back to India, start something, and that something was dying out. So we both moved back sometime in 2011 and we started dying out in early 2012, February 2012. And at that point in time, as you said, it wasn't like the food tech market was not evolved. There was no startup ecosystem in India, right? It was like just beginning. So our parents, obviously, you know, families thought that we're a crazy bunch of people quitting our, you know, high paying jobs in London and the US and coming back. And in this venture, we were actually joined by two other co-founders, Vivek and Nikhil. And the interesting point of this is that between me, Vivek and Sahil, we had never worked in India. So Vivek was in the Merchant Navy and he had traveled. He'd been on the ship, you know, for the last 8 odd years. Sahil did his MBA from here and then went to the US and he was working in the US. And the other interesting bit is that all four of us had known each other since we were 5 years old. So we've been friends for over, 20 plus years. When we decided to start Dine Out, we went to nursery together and that's how we knew each other. So when we decided to start Dine Out, it was actually not our parents that we had to convince. It was set of, you know, four parents that we had to convince. And you can imagine at that point in time, and we were just, you know, all of us were around 26, 27 at that point in time. And the biggest problem that their parents had was that, you know, tum log se shaadi kaun karega? Because that is what, you know, because obviously the tech ecosystem is not devolved. And the funny bit is that within 1 year of starting Dine Out, three of us were married. And that was again because of sort of, you know, we wouldn't want to call it out loud in front of our wives with parental pressure or whatever you want to say, right? Yaar, tum log shaadi kar lo, so our headache is over. And then you guys can sort of, you know, do whatever you want to. And obviously, the industry that we chose, you know, this entire F&B industry. So there were a few reasons, right? One, obviously, because of our personal experience as to, you know, lack of finding a good restaurant. But I think the second or the main reason was that because we had been living in, UK and London respectively, so London and US for such a long time respectively, we had seen that entire F&B industry evolve over the last 4 or 5 years in those markets. And we felt that, you know, India is obviously not far behind and there will be a time where India is also going to evolve massively. And food, when you break it down to the lowest common denominator, food is something that binds people together. We Indians love to eat food, love our food. We love going out to restaurants. So we just felt that it was a large enough market with a large problem that probably that needs to be addressed. And that's how the whole concept of Dine Out started. And we launched Dine Out in February of 2012. And obviously, we've come a long way. So we started off as a pure sort of a table reservation platform. But now, by the end of it, you know, we were a complete F&B, you know, restaurant tech ecosystem. And happy to sort of talk about that journey.
No, absolutely. I think it's very exciting and always interesting to hear how humble the beginnings are, but how far the journey takes you, and goes to show that it needs a lot of resilience. But coming to that side, I think for me also, what I was most fascinated to read more about is that Dine Out has such a large B2B side to it as well, right? We as consumers don't get to see that, but it's so interesting. There's so many things happening. So maybe if you can take us to that transformation, right? Because I'm sure there was so much happening. There's a lot of noise in ecosystems which are hot, and companies like Zomato, Swiggy, which you're now a part of, have raised a ton of venture capital money as well over the years. So there were, I'm sure, multiple opportunities for you, but you chose some and then chose to excel in them. Talk to us about how did you make those choices, and maybe give us a preview of all that Dine Out does today in its current avatar.
No, absolutely. I think it was a matter of going deep into the industry and figuring out what the multiple use cases were, and then just trying to solve one problem after the other. And one of the most exciting things about the restaurant industry for us was that, you know, we all know that the restaurant industry, or actually we now know that the restaurant industry is so fragmented that unlike any other hospitality industry, whether it's airlines or hotels where there are large players who actually then go on to build their own technology. Because the industry was so fragmented, we realized that the hundreds of thousands of restaurants that exist will not have the wherewithal to build their own platforms or systems to make life efficient for them. And hence, we decided to tackle that problem. But it was again, a step-by-step evolution. So we started off with table reservations to begin with in 2012. And, we started off with an online platform. But we went live on 29th February 2012. And on 1st March 2012, we realized that pure online in India doesn't work. So we had to go set up a call center within a week. Because during those times, people love to call Just Dial to take numbers. And we took that concept one step further. And we had agents where people could actually, where we started giving people recommendations. Okay, if you're a group of four people or friends or family, where can you go? What is good? Depending on the cuisine. So it became a very personalized service. And that's how the actual original platform DineOut took off. Because people loved that personalization that we were able to offer. That we were offering and helping them decide a restaurant as compared to, let's say, a Just Dial where you would just get could ask the number of a restaurant. So that's how the entire journey started, right? And then once we sort of started growing into it, we started interacting more and more with the restaurant partners. We realized that, we were just scratching the surface of the problem, because now what happened was that I'm sending customers to the restaurant, but there is no way for us to verify if the customers actually visited the restaurant or not. And our success, like our revenues were based on, in those initial days, were based on the number of people we sent to the restaurant. But now I would say that you're a restauranter and I've sent 500 people through reservations. The restauranter would turn around and say, no, actually only 200 came. And there's no way to verify until you call every single person, right? And that wasn't feasible. So then our first step into this entire B2B journey was trying to figure out a way to, like, an electronic register. And when we looked in the market, we realized that nothing like this exists. And we wanted to then, we spoke to a lot of the restaurateurs as well. And the biggest problem that the restaurateurs were facing at that point in time was that, or there were multiple problems. The first problem was that, let's say, Ankit visited the restaurant. There's no way for the restaurateur to know whether it's my first visit or my 10th visit, because there was no way to identify me as a user. The second problem was that I could have been a very valuable and a loyal user, and it could have been my 10th visit to the restaurant, but they would treat me the same way as they would treat, let's say, you probably on your first visit. Because again, there's no way to identify users. The other problem was that because they couldn't identify the users, they had to spend the same amount of money on acquiring an existing user versus a new user, because there is no way to distinguish. So the amount of money being spent across, whether it was digital or other offline channels was the same. So when we started to look into all of this, we realized that actually we need to solve this problem for the restaurateur to make a life a lot easier for them. And that is when we sort of started to develop our own sort of, we call it ERB, electronic reservation book. And when we started to sort of get in that journey, we realized that, it's actually a much bigger problem to be solved, because, think about it, right? There are billions, or so in India, for example, across all restaurants, there are more than 5 billion covers that are visiting annually in a year. Now, any decent restaurant who's doing, let's say, 1 crore of GMV or revenues a month, which is, which is a successful restaurant, is probably, attracting 15 to 20,000 people a month. So that's around nearly 250,000 to 300,000 people a year. But looking back on it, they have no idea who those people are, because they are not able to record their visits. And because you cannot record their visits, you don't know how much they're spending. You don't know what their eating habits are, et cetera, et cetera, right? So there was no, in a way, restaurants at that point in time were operating in a very blind environment, and there was no way they were utilizing data. So then we embarked on this mission to ensure that we're able to solve, that entire problem for them and get them to recognize their customers. So that was the mission. So this is now, it took us a couple of, so this is now 2014-15. By the time we realized that, okay, we need to actually build a B2B solution to be more effective on the B2C side as well. We realized that instead of actually building, this entire solution ourselves, we actually met a company called InResto, who were doing something same. And that was the first acquisition that we did in 2015. We acquired Inresto. And from there on, you know, our entire B2B journey started. And over the years, we've went on to acquire multiple sort of companies on both the B2B side and the B2C side, because we were building an entire end-to-end ecosystem for the dining out industry and for restaurants as well. And one of the things that we always realized early on is that we wanted to focus on the dining outside, because unlike, you know, when I give, for example, from a restaurant or an industry perspective, dining out is nearly 4x bigger than delivery, right? So a restaurant does 20% of its revenue in delivery. Like, I'm talking about a proper restaurant, which has a physical premise and not a cloud kitchen or something like that. Even in fact, the concept of cloud kitchens is, you know, over the last 5 years, something has happened, you know, 2012, 13, 14, it didn't exist, right? So at that point in time, restaurants used to rely 20% on delivery, but 80% was on people visiting them. So that was a much larger problem and a much larger industry that we had to sort of cater to. And, you know, with Swiggy, so Zomato obviously was there before us, and their pivot in food delivery happened around 2015. And then I think Swiggy's also started 2014. But at that time, we decided to stick to this to solve this proposition of dining out, as well as the B2B tech ecosystem for the restaurant, because we felt that that's also a large enough problem to be solved. And also, if you remember that time, right, 2014, just after Modi had won the, Mr. Modi had won the election, there was this whole influx of capital coming into India. So in my last 10, 12 years of journey, I think the pivotal moment for the Indian ecosystem was 2014, May, after Mr. Modi won the election. I think the floodgates opened in India, a lot of FDI came in, and that's when the Indian startup ecosystem actually took off. And I remember a time like 14, 15, where there were nearly 10 new food delivery services that had come up, right? So at that point in time, it became very difficult. It was a very difficult decision for us to actually, whether we follow the money or whether we sort of, you know, stick to our core, what we actually started off with. And in hindsight, obviously, you know, we believe we made the right decision of sticking to our core, because technically now, if you look at it, there's only Zomato, Swiggy, and Dineout, which have now, you know, survived this entire last 7-8 years journey into the entire food tech ecosystem.
Yeah, no, I think kudos to the work you've done. And I think a lot of important lessons there, just sticking to the core, as you mentioned, focus mostly wins, and your journey and the Dineout journey is a testament to it. A very interesting thing that I wanted to ask anyway is that, you know, the build versus buy sort of a strategy. And Dineout has, you know, the way you started also, the tech was outsourced at the beginning, even though all of you were engineers. And over time also, when building out the B2B piece, you've gone ahead and bought companies. Talk to us about that mindset very quickly. I think it's an interesting one, because at that time, I'm guessing the M&A ecosystem was also not as vibrant. So it wasn't as heard of to acquire companies and expand, but you've always done that. So is there any, you know, strategy to it?
No, absolutely. So I think when we first started Dineout, obviously the idea was to always, you know, build everything. But I think over a period of years, our thought process also evolved. And I think the first step towards that was, in fact, our acquisition in 2014 by Times Internet. Times Internet was a partner for us on the B2C side, where they had a property called Time City. Time City was a listing or a directory, and we had the fulfillment of the booking engine. So we were placing our booking widgets on Time City's website to complete the journey for a user visiting Time City. And that's where, you know, it became really interesting. We saw some great results, and ultimately Times Internet sort of acquired us. I wouldn't say they acquired us, but we as founders still had some equity to keep the business going. So it was that sort of arrangement. But that is when we first realized, and to be honest, when we had first started off in 2012, you know, the idea was to build a sustainable business. We didn't think that we wanted to sort of, you know, within 2 years, something like this is going to happen. So, and again, at a time when the ecosystem was not developed, there was not enough acquisitions, etc., stuff like this happening, right? So it was a good pivotal moment for us. See, and that actually taught us a lot of things about that build versus buy, where when a bigger entity is coming in, sort of acquiring us as opposed to building. And that's when we started to get into the deep end of it. And what we realized at that point in time is that it makes sense if your objectives and goals are aligned. It makes sense to combine forces with someone rather than try to reinvent the wheel, you know, all the time. Because together, I honestly believe that, you know, if you're aligned, a lot of things can be achieved. And it's, you know, and honestly, that's something that we followed throughout our journey. And now we've seen that happen with Swiggy as well, with them acquiring us just earlier this year. So that happened. Then our first deal happened, what I just mentioned earlier, right? Interesto in 2015. And Interesto now gave us the ability to actually record every single person visiting a restaurant, because it was an electronic diary which sat at the front end of, at the concierge or at the manager, at the entrance of the restaurant. And it did a very simple thing. All it did was that it recorded the phone number and name of every single person visiting the restaurant. By 2015, right, restaurant industry had started to evolve. A lot more restaurateurs, like a modern day restaurant, young generation was joining the industry. A lot of chains were coming up. And the biggest problem that we saw was that, now taking the example of, let's say, Social, right? When they're opening and open, so now they have multiple outlets in the same city and outlets across the country. The biggest challenge that they faced was that Ankit was visiting, let's say, Social Hoskhas village for the first time, but maybe he would have visited, I would have visited five different outlets in the last 2-3 months, but that outlet had no idea about me as a person. So they were treating me as a new customer always. So by now, me being able to provide a software in Resto, which was recording every single visit, as soon as I was giving my phone number, instantly the outlet knew, okay, this is Ankit. He's visiting us for maybe the second time, but across, he's visited all Socials, probably 10 times. And, he's a loyal customer, so maybe he should be treated differently. There could be a different offer for him, etc., etc. So that was the first problem that we solved. And we connected this to Dine Out as well. And that made life easier for Dine Out, because now whenever I was sending a customer to a restaurant, I was inputting the name and number of the customer directly into Resto. And if the customer arrived at the restaurant, they would just mark it as arrived. So it became a tool for managing reservations. It became a tool for capturing all guests that were walking in. And hence it became that is how the entire sort of restaurant database started to build. So from a dine out perspective, it solved the entire reconciliation journey for us. From a restaurant perspective, it started to build a database. Now, once I have the database of a user, I can then do multiple great things on it. So for example, again, just building on, now Social knows that Ankit is visiting them maybe once in every 3 weeks or once a month. Now they can run a regression on the entire database to see, okay, these are the set of customers who are visiting me once a month, but have now not visited me for the last 3 months. Let me send out a personalized offer to them, target them to come back. And all of this was being done at the price of an SMS, which was 10 paise. But so from a economics and a marketing channel, it was the best performing channel for the restaurants, because they would, let's say, send out an SMS to 1,000 people, which would cost them, 100 odd rupees or something like that. And even if, the conversion was 1%, where out of those 1,000 people, maybe 10 people showed up, they would end up spending, let's say, an average bill, at a Social is, let's say, 3,000 rupees. So those 10 people in their groups would end up generating, 30,000 rupees worth of revenue for the restaurant. So on a input of 100 rupees, they generate a output of 30,000. So that ROI was unbeatable. And that is why, and that is actually which led to the popularity of Interesto. And from there on, we grew. And at its peak, Interesto was recording close to 10 million customer entries a month. So like capturing 120 million, customer visits across partner restaurants. So that was the first step of Interesto and our journey on B2B side. But what we realized is that Interesto was only at the front of the desk. Now, the second problem in this was that, now I know that Ankit is visiting me 10 times a month. So that's something that's happening. And Interesto was also seating Ankit. Like it was also used for table management. So they would seat Ankit on, let's say, table number 5. And when I'm sitting on, when they open me, when they seat me on table number 5, they will open table number 5 in the POS, which is the POS, where all the ordering happens. But that again is a black box, which doesn't know who's sitting on table number 5. So now Interesto knows that Ankit is sitting on table number 5. The restaurant's POS knows that someone sitting on table number 5 has just ordered food and drinks worth 10,000 rupees, but there's no way to connect the two. So at that point in time, it took us a couple of years to actually get full, to develop Interesto, grow it, and to have it at critical mass. So at, by 2017, 18, we were nearly deployed at around 20 odd thousand restaurants capturing that 120 odd million data points annually. But the problem now was that I have these 120 million people but visiting the restaurants, but I do not know what they are ordering. I do not know what their bill amount is. So I cannot do anything with it. So at that point in time, we started to sort of look into this POS space in India, and we realized that it's a very fragmented space. So we actually went out and integrated InResto with, you know, 20, 25 different POS companies to have that manage that data flow, where now essentially Ankit sitting on table number 5 has ordered 10,000 rupees worth of food and drink. Now the restaurant is aware of this. Now, once the restaurant is aware of this, now they can do a lot of stuff. When Ankit visits them again, they can do personalized recommendation, they can do personalized offers, they can do upsells, they can do a lot of stuff. But the challenge that we faced at that point in time was that we had to now integrate with 20 different systems, and it was a nightmare to manage. Like, you can imagine how B2B integrations happen, and it was a challenge to manage databases. It was a nightmare to do all of that and ensure that there's seamless flow of information happening. So at that point in time, we thought that should we build our own POS? And we started work on that. But then again, we realized that, the question of build versus buy, do I spend, some millions of dollars in manpower, waste, 2 years of trying to build this, which, there are already 25, 30 players out there. Or do I try to go and find like-minded people who we can go sort of acquire? And that is what led to our second acquisition in the B2B space, which was the acquisition of a company called Torqus, which was at that point in time the third largest POS system in India. And that instantly gave us a lot of synergies because we were able to now solve this entire end-to-end journey from a restaurant's perspective. So now, for example, I know that Ankit has reserved through DineOut, or he could probably walk into the restaurant as well. And now Ankit is seated on table number 5. This is his, maybe 5th visit. He likes to order butter chicken, which he likes to consume with whiskey. So can I do a personalized offer for him? And we were now reached that point in time. So while we were doing this over 2014, 15 to 18, the DineOut B2C side was also going sort of fairly strong. So we had evolved from a table reservation platform. So now the advantage of reserving tables with DineOut over time became that you could get an offer at every single reservation. So that became the USP, and that's what propelled our growth in that 2015-16 period. So two things. One was obviously that offer thing, and then 2014-15 is when we actually launched our mobile, and we went from web to mobile, and obviously that is when our growth on the consumer side happened. But still, we realized that people were reserving tables, but from a DineOut perspective, there was no way to attribute how much money was being spent by that consumer. So for example, I was charging restaurants a flat fee per every consumer that has spent. Now, irrespective of whether the consumer went and spent 500 rupees or 5,000 rupees. And we felt that, that was probably not the right model for us as a business, where I could be sending lakhs of business to a restaurant, but I'm only being paid an X amount of money. So in a way, our upside got capped. At that point in time, we tried to figure out, what are the different models that we could sort of, adopt on the consumer side. And we realized that payments is obviously the lowest common denominator, right? That happens across restaurants. Like everyone who visits a restaurant needs to pay their bill. So in 2016-17 is when we launched DineOut Pay, which essentially meant, and we were probably the first, product of its kind in India where you could pay your, now you could reserve a table, get a discount, and now pay also at the restaurant using the DineOut app. And essentially what we had done was that we had integrated all sort of wallets at that point in time. We had integrated credit cards, everything, right? So we became a one-stop sort of shop for facilitating digital payments at restaurants. And that actually, was something that worked really well for us from a consumer perspective. Because now, we were able to complete the loop for the consumer, but also from a DineOut perspective, because now we were able to we were charging a commission on every transaction that happened through the DineOut app. And that, that, for example, was obviously, when it comes to commission, it becomes uncapped, right? The more someone spends, the more we earn as a company. So that was going really well. And then I think the propellant for DineOut Pay was demonetization, right? out of the blue, demonetization happened. The entire shift to digital happened. And obviously, a lot of people started paying, via at the restaurant, also via dine out, right? So that gave us a huge boost on the consumer side. And while we were doing this, so dine out and dine out pay was always for the masses, in the sense that, you know, we had nearly 25,000-30,000 restaurants on the platform, transactions, five stars, etc. We felt that we needed to build a proposition for our most valuable customers, so, you know, the top 5% of dine out users. So we actually started a program called Dine Out Pass, Dine Out Plus at that point in time, which was a five star only program where consumers could get a flat 25% discount at five stars. We were selling it in B2B channels. We were selling it to a lot of banks, and we were, you know, selling it to the consumers. And again, we came across a product called Gourmet Passport in the market at that point in time, which was also doing something similar, where it was a program for, you know, the top 5% of consumers visiting restaurants, which was offering a buy one, get one free at the top 2,000 restaurants across the country. Top 1,000 when we sort of acquired them. So again, the problem, the question in front of us was, do we spend money and energy trying to fight them, or do we just join forces? And eventually in 2018, we ended up acquiring Gourmet Passport on the B2C side and merged it with our consumer offering. So, you know, it became a really busy period for us, where we were actively growing the business, but we were also actively sort of, you know, acquiring multiple companies, trying to fit in the B2B side and trying to complete the B2B side and the B2C side of the journey. And I just mentioned, right, so 2018, we had just acquired this company called Torkus. We were now integrating them. We had another new product that we could sell. So from a restaurant perspective, our story became a lot stronger, where we could say that now we can help you acquire, retain, and re-engage users. So that was the pitch that we were using with Torkus. And the next set of evolution, which sort of married the B2B and B2C together, was that what we realized is that, and a lot of restaurateurs again sort of spoke to us about that, is that the concept of dynamic pricing doesn't exist in the restaurant industry. So what I mean by that is, across all other hospitality sectors, whether it's airlines, whether it's hotels, even, you know, Uber, Ola, etc., right? You have a demand supply game where at peak times, even cinemas, right? Flights over weekends are a lot more expensive. Hotels during peak times are a lot more expensive. But why is it that at a restaurant, when Tuesday afternoon probably is empty with 10% occupancy, and a Saturday evening with 100% occupancy and with another 20%, you know, people waiting outside, should a restaurant charge the same price for a beer? Can their dynamic pricing not exist in the restaurant industry? And the biggest problem or the pain point to that was that menus were basically printed. So it became really difficult for someone to implement dynamic pricing, because you couldn't go around, you know, it was very cumbersome to print four different versions of the menu. Our next problem to solve became exactly this. How do we figure out dynamic pricing? Because see, we have now all the ingredients, right? We have a B2C platform. We have real-time data coming from the POS. And POS is actually the source of truth for the for the pricing of the menu, right? Because everything is input there. And we have access to the consumers. We know restaurant capacity utilization on a Saturday versus a Tuesday. So why can we not sort of address that? And when we sort of looked, you know, tried to venture into this, we came across a company called Binge Digital that was already trying to solve this. So in 2019, we ended up acquiring them to build out this entire, digital menu for us. Restaurants were liking this proposition. We had started to deploy towards the end of 2019 is when we had started to deploy it to, this entire digital menu at our partner restaurants. And then we all know what happened in 2020 was a ball breaker for the industry with COVID, where the industry went to a complete standstill. And just before that, right? So on the consumer side, with the acquisition of Gourmet Pass and the merger of Gourmet Pass on the Dine Out app, we were growing by leaps and bounds. And then we also had introduced a new concept for the first time in the restaurant industry called the Great Indian Restaurant Festival, or GRF. Basically, what we realized is that there are shopping festivals, Amazon, Flipkart, everyone are doing, you know, the likes of the Big Billion Day, etc. There are a lot of shopping festivals happening, but nothing like that had ever been done for the restaurant industry. So we came up with this concept in 2017 for the first time, where we thought, can we actually do a national level celebration of dining out, where we would get restaurants to offer a 50% discount at a to our consumers. That just took off like crazy, right? So 2018 we did it. 2019 actually we ended up doing it twice a year in February and August, because the demand was so much and the proposition was simple, right? We had 50% discount uncapped. So it was unheard of before in the industry, where at that point in time food delivery guys were doing crazy 50% discount, but there was always a star with maximum of 100 rupees, 200 rupees, something like that, right? Hotel, everywhere you had, people were using 50% as a hook, but it was always capped to a certain level. And then here we came, said 50% discount, completely uncapped. So, and people just went crazy. So on a bill of 10,000, you could actually save 5,000 rupees. And restaurants loved it, because while it was 50% discount, it was only to a limited set of covers. So the way we had modeled it was very intelligently, where we were offering this, every restaurant we went to, we said, okay, it's only for 500 covers or 600 covers in the entire month. So that's only 20 covers a day, which from a percentage of covers visiting them was only 5 to 10%. But the impact of that was huge, because all of a sudden, we had 10,000 restaurants across the country offering 50% off for the entire month. And that was uncapped. So that was unheard of. It went viral. By the end of it, just before COVID, we were seating around 5 million. We seated, I think, around 5 million odd covers on GRF in February 20. So that was the addition that we had done. So, 2018 was when we consolidated, when we did a lot of acquisitions. 2019 was a period of consolidation. Early 2019 was a period of consolidation for us. And end of 2019 was, we were on a crazy growth trajectory. We were out in the market to raise external funding because we were growing so much. Times wanted to have an external investor on board. We received a lot of interest. But then, we know that, from the peak of here, it just all tanked in 2020 with COVID, right? A very difficult period for all of us, because the industry went to a complete standstill. Never before had it happened in the history of the world that the restaurant industry across the world was shut. Not even in World War I and II were restaurants shut completely, right? In fact, restaurants were places of refuge and entertainment at that point in time. And here we've gone from being okay to being completely shut overnight. And, difficult times, difficult period, a lot of restaurants, so the impact in India was huge, because unlike Europe and the US, where the government came in to support restaurants, in India, there was zero aid coming in from the government, right? Nearly 40% of the restaurants in that period shut down. The first wave, from March, April till sort of September, October, was still a wave of solidarity. We all were in it together. We never knew what people wanted to, just sort of, for facing it together. So, difficult times where people thought, okay, there's going to be sort of light at the end of the tunnel. Things opened up in October onwards. Things were starting to go sort of well. We were seeing some good growth. We in fact ended up doing GRF in 2021 March, and then again the second wave happened. And we all know the Delta wave was really bad in India, and that is when something that broke the spirit of the industry. And that is when we saw a massive sort of round of restaurant closures, etc., happening. And during that time, right, from the between March 2020, when the first wave happened, till March 21, in that 12 months, we actually went out to consolidate a lot of our business. So, because just before COVID, we were growing like crazy, we were burning a lot of money. So we thought that was a period in time when we had to actually sort of cut down on a lot of expenses. We actually reworked our business model massively. On the enterprise side, we had to obviously sustain, we had to help a lot of restaurants come back from COVID. We gave out a lot, we extended a lot of licenses for free. We gave out, our B2B software for free. And in fact, we were the pioneers of digital menu. So we had started working on digital menu just before COVID. And COVID, from that perspective, was a boon for the... So COVID was, what I would like to say is COVID was the actual default CTO for the restaurant industry, because all of a sudden, restaurants across the world were looking at ways in how technology could assist them, right? Right from lowering their customer acquisition cost to digital menus to, to digitizing the entire process of when a customer visits. So in fact, we were the pioneers of digital menu. And the entire journey of a consumer visiting the restaurant, within a short period of 6 months, we had nearly 10,000 restaurants on our digital menu. And essentially, it wasn't just the digital menu, it was actually the process. So a customer could, and at that point in time, there was paranoia around large groups gathering. Even when malls had opened up, there was a limited number of people, etc. So the entire journey of the consumer became that you could actually scan either a QR code to reserve a table when you enter a mall, or you could actually reserve a table on Dine Out. You could actually then see the digital menu. You could actually order as well before arriving at the restaurant, or even when you're sitting at the restaurant, because no one wanted to touch physical menus, right? Because you don't want to, so there's again the paranoia around, the entire COVID thing. And you could actually order through the app or through a link, which was, which we had generated for the restaurant, custom links. You could then actually pay your bill and walk out of the restaurant without touching anything. So that entire journey was something that, we worked on, we saw great success in that. So on the B2B side, actually coming out of COVID, we did our B2B business actually became a lot more stronger. Restaurants started to realize the need for B2B solutions a lot more. Just to give you a small example, right? Take the example of a large chain, let's say Social, right? Who's 40, 50 odd outlets across the country, has a database of around, 500,000 users. Now, when they're starting again post the first wave, right? Everyone's starting from scratch. And now all of a sudden, Social could use InResto to reach out to all these 500,000 people, telling them, now we are open. We are following all safety protocols. Why don't you come visit us? Here's a customized offer, et cetera, et cetera. So all of a sudden, post-COVID, people saw the power of InResto from as a marketing channel as well. And I think there was a time that in a short time of 6 months, that nearly a billion SMSs were sent using the platform, because everyone sort of wanted reaching out to the customers, customized offers, et cetera, et cetera. So it just became a crazy period of adoption for B2B. And on the B2C side, we also made some fundamental changes to our business model where, earlier, for example, you had to reserve a table and you could get a discount. But then when there was some extra incentive to pay via Dine Out, and we were burning a lot of money on that. So we changed the model completely, where we said that now, you could reserve a table as well. Because see, at that point in time, now all of a sudden, post-COVID, reservation became sort of a mandate. Like, people wanted to reserve so that they don't have to go wait in queues, interact with people, right? So reservation from a push product all of a sudden became a pull feature for consumers. And we transferred that onus of discount to actually bill payment. So reservation was free, but to get a discount, you have to pay the bill. And that actually saw a huge adoption for us post-COVID. And, within 6 months, we were back to our pre-COVID numbers. And, when things were getting better, the second wave happened. But post the second wave, within 3 months, we were back again. And within 6 months, we were 3x of our pre-COVID numbers. And that is when, the actual conversation conversations with multiple sort of, we actually got, because of our resurgence over that, between wave one and two, and then post wave two, we saw a lot of interest from people, in this, people who wanted to sort of acquire, because what had happened during that, this entire COVID period is that the mental model of people shifted, right? Like, all of a sudden, people were away from loved ones. People had stopped meeting people. People had stopped going out. This entire work from home culture became. So this need for social sort of accept or meeting people became a lot more stronger. And because people went through difficult times during COVID, people, we knew that coming out of it, there's going to be this whole revenge consumption, and people are wanting to be go out. People would want to go out a lot more. So in fact, we could foresee this trend happening. And in fact, in the middle of COVID, in August 2020, we actually ended up acquiring a company called Stepping Out, which was India's largest events company at that point in time, because we knew that post, whenever this subsided, there is going to be this hunger in people to go experience life a lot more. And we knew that what is going to happen is that, see, restaurants are going to come back, but people are probably not going to be traveling that much, or cinemas are going to take some time to come back. People would want to experience more life events, experience more newer things. So we knew that the event industry is going to bounce back very strongly. So we ended up acquiring Stepping Out in August of 2020, and between wave one and wave two, we saw a lot of events, and we saw great adoption. But post wave two, the, you know, this events industry also just went crazy and we were seeing great traction. So here is Dineout now, you know, around July 21 to August 21, just coming out of the second wave, poised as this, you know, stepping out company. Like we, so from dining out, our entire messaging changed to helping consumers visit out, whether it's for restaurants or whether it's events, etc. And that became attractive to a lot of companies all of a sudden. And that is when, you know, we started conversations with multiple sort of companies who had an interest to acquire us. And eventually, I think, you know, after multiple rounds of discussions and negotiation, etc., I think, you know, we settled on, we decided to go ahead with Swiggy because I think our DNAs matched. Plus, we were a great fit for Swiggy because Swiggy was great at sort of moving, you know, pieces, moving atoms from place A to place B. But then in comes Dineout, which is now helping people dine out, you know, visit out. So we complemented their food delivery and Instamart business with the whole dining out business because ultimately, and the stepping out business because ultimately the same people who are ordering massively during, you know, this times of COVID, etc., would now want to visit out. And it was important for Swiggy to have that. And with Swiggy also, the story was similar, right? They post wave one, they were trying to build something for themselves, but they realized that it's going to take a lot of time for them to be able to catch up or build a substantial product. Their competition, Zomato, at that time already had dining out. They had the pro program, etc. And so it became, again, a question of build versus buy for Swiggy. And ultimately, I think we decided that together we can build a much larger business a lot faster. And hence, the decision to sort of Swiggy to acquire Dineout and we moving to Swiggy.
Got it. No, that's spectacular, Ankit. Thanks for walking us through that. I was reminiscing as a consumer of the food industry, you can, you know, reminisce some of these things. I was relating to the stepping out concert I was at a week ago and other things, the gourmet passes and stuff like that. But it's so, I think anybody who wants to start a restaurant business could take that entire snippet and be like, okay, these are the changes that have happened. I need to focus on these things because you just took us through all the moving pieces across the last decade there. And I think that is very, very structured and in-depth to hear. So thanks for sharing that again. This is exciting. I didn't realize that, you know, we're almost at the end of time. But I have just a final couple of questions before we wrap up. One thing there is, you know, as you mentioned about some of these acquisitions, I was thinking in my head that there are these different business models and different companies coming into one. How do you manage the human capital problem, right? And across a period of time, because now you've been building for 10 plus years, considering it started in 2012. Talk to us about how do you look at seeing people evolve over different roles, organization design, and when externally people are coming into the organization by virtue of an acquisition, how do you make them settled in now that you yourself might be going through that journey as well, right, with Swiggy? So maybe that's something interesting to understand from your lens.
No, absolutely. I think that solving human capital is probably the most difficult and most important challenge in any acquisition. And we've seen, you know, multiple instances, not just in India, but across the globe, where large acquisitions happened, which have fallen through, or which have not resulted in any material impact because of difference, you know, in the way companies are run, the culture, etc. So I think the philosophy that we followed at Dineout always was that we have to get like-minded people on board and we have to incentivize them so that we all succeed together. And in fact, one of the things that I can proudly say is that during the journey of Dineout, we ended up acquiring five companies, which meant that across these five companies, we had probably 11 or 12 founders. And out of those, by at the end of it, nearly, you know, nine of them were still working with us when Swiggy acquired us. And that to me was a testament of sort of, you know, how we were able to align all our interests together. I think at the most basic level, it was about, you know, when you were making an acquisition, right? There are always multiple companies that you can sort of acquire. And at every instance, we evaluated different multiple companies. And I think more than the product or, you know, the market position of that company, I think the deciding factor for us to go ahead with the acquisition was always the people, you know, the founders, the vision which they had started the company, you know, the vision of how and where they want to take the company, and how they want, so how they want to see the acquisition as. So, you know, one of the models that we always followed was that we never gave a, it wasn't sort of a massive payout sort of an acquisition. It was always positioned in a way that, okay, you're coming on board and together if we succeed, you are going to have a payout, right? So we always sort of incentivize people to work with us and succeed, because together is how we would succeed. So whether it was the matter of, you know, Gourmet Passport founders, they had, you know, they had a 5-year payout window where, you know, together the larger the business became, the more money they would make. Or the same with Inresto, the more number of restaurants we acquire, the more money they make. Or the same with Torcus as well, the more money, you know, the more number of restaurants. So because we always align ourselves to the overall vision of growing the industry, whether it's the consumer or the enterprise, it just fell in. We were aligned with the overall vision. Like everyone was aligned with the overall vision. And I think we had to walk away from also a few deals because probably they were in spite of them being the market leaders, we had to walk away because of this, you know, alignment of the people.
Got it. Well, that speaks volumes of the culture and the fundamentals that actually builds a long-standing organization, which Dynot, of course, is testament of. But this is great. I think very, very helpful to know. As we close down, I'd love to ask you a couple of last questions on your personal self. One thing there is we can look at, you know, the Dynot journey and be like, okay, there's been so much growth, acquisition at this number, whatnot, but very difficult to quantify a founder's journey, right? And their growth. If you had to give us on, you know, the qualitative side of what this founder journey has done to you, I think that'll be very heartening to hear, because a lot of people look at entrepreneurship, look at successful exits, valuation numbers, and think of it as a glory ride. While of course it is very, very fulfilling, it's not easy by any length of it. So if you had to maybe just share personal learnings of what the founder journey means for you, I think that'll be very helpful, Ankit.
Yeah, I think the one fundamental shift in mindset that I've seen myself evolve over is that, so as an investment banker, as a CFA charter holder, as someone who's trying to make a career, right? I always wanted to be the smartest person in the room, to the place where I am now, where I want to hire some people smarter than me, right? I want to now be the least smartest people on the team, right? So I think that evolution, you know, while it sounds easy, actually takes a lot of time for a founder to realize that, you know, and that's what we realized on our journey, right? That A, I cannot do everything. B, I don't want to do everything. And C, I should get people who are better at doing stuff than, so first is acknowledging to yourself that, okay, you know, probably, you know, you can't do everything and, you know, you need people better than you. I think that shift happened somewhere in the middle of our journey around 2015-16, when we realized that, you know, actually to succeed, we need to build a world-class team, hire better people. And obviously better people in India always come with a much higher salary. And I think as a founder, I think the realization that you need to hire people, like it's not necessary that just because you're the founder, you're going to be the highest paid person, or even because you're the CEO, you're going to be the highest paid person in the company. So hiring those specialists, you know, understanding that to take a, you know, to build a company and build a sustainable company requires a great set of people. So that, I think, was a lesson in sort of humbleness, lesson in, you know, self-actualization and self-acceptance. And I see a lot of, in my journey, I've been now investing in startups since 2015, work very closely with a lot of, you know, early stage founders who I've seen grow and evolve. And, you know, I think that's the most difficult thing that I see in early stage founders, which they need to overcome, is that, okay, that just because I'm a startup founder, I don't necessarily mean that I have to be the highest paid person in the team. That doesn't necessarily mean that I can go and do everything. That doesn't mean that I have to be the smartest person in the room. I need to hire people better than me. And to be honest, the guys who scaled up really well have actually cracked that. They know that, they understand that. So for me, that probably has been one of the most important self-discovery journeys. See, everything else you will figure out, right? You will figure out the product, the right product market fit. You'll figure out when you need to pivot. You will sort of do all of that. And in doing all of that, you don't there's no ego that is there, you know, because you know that's something that the business demands, or that's something the consumers demand, or that's something the industry demand. But actually hiring people, acknowledging to yourself that there are people better than you out there, going out acquiring, getting, convincing them to come work for you, that I think that is something which probably is something I would say has been my most defining sort of lesson, you know, in my journey.
I think that's wonderful to hear, because it's very humbling to know that you have to accept these things along the way, and you can't have, I mean, the mission is such just so large that you can't be self-centered that way. The company is always bigger than you, and you have to continuously be in that loop. Lovely. I think I love that. That would be a great note to end on. But of course, we've spoken about the past. It would only be fitting to talk about the future. Now that, you know, with Swiggy, you're probably the largest player in the food tech ecosystem of the country. And there's so much happening, and you've already seen so much. Where do you think, you know, your journey heads next? What are plans for the future? What keeps you going to date after, you know, this journey? If you can maybe shed light on that and maybe leave us with some interesting thoughts, I think that'll be a great ending point.
No, absolutely. You know, obviously, it's a moment, right? You know, when this acquisition happened, like, you know, multiple thoughts that go through my mind. First of all, is that, you know, would you want to continue? Is this something that you want? Are you motivated to do this for the next few years, or do you go build something else? And I think the thing that we realized together with Swiggy is the fact that, you know, the industry itself is huge, the dining out industry, and we've just scratched the surface of it. So I see a huge potential for growth. And in fact, with Swiggy is where we see our 10x growth happening from here on, you know, over the next few years. So from that perspective, we are completely, totally committed to, you know, build this out over the next few years and to have dine out by itself as a, you know, $1 billion plus category. So that's something that we are already sort of working on. That motivates us, that, you know, excites us. And that to me is where the dine out journey should head to, and I will continue to be a part of that. But also, having said that, right, over the last few years, as I said, right, I've been the entrepreneurial, the Kida is always there, right, to do something more. There are so many other problems to solve. And one of the ways that I've figured out is that, obviously, you know, I've been investing now in the startup ecosystem since 2015. And over the last couple of years, I've gone really fast, like, you know, probably, you know, now my portfolio consists of around 40 odd companies. And I choose to work with sort of first-time founders. I prefer to be the first sort of investor into the company where I can help founders reduce their time to market. See, I think what really matters today is that if I have an idea, there are going to be probably in the first 12 months of my journey, there are going to be multiple iterations, pivots that I need to take, you know, multiple decisions that I need to make. And I think having done this journey ourselves, I think even if we are able to help a founder save, you know, 3-4 months in that initial 12-month period, that is where the value lies and that is where the magic lies. And I think that is what excites us, right? So actively we take, you know, we want to be the first check into the company. Now with my co-founders, we run and there are now other people. So we run an active syndicate. We are sector agnostic. We're just looking for people who are helping solve large problems, and to whom we can contribute on ground. See, I don't promise a lot of money to a founder. What I promise is that, you know, that experience of being a first-time founder and building a business on ground. So we bring that operational know-how to the table, right? How can you maximize on marketing? How can you help on reducing CAC? How can you make operational efficiencies, etc.? So those are some of the things that we focus on. So we roll up our sleeves and dedicate time to the founders and get on the ground and get us hands dirty with them. And that is what excites me, honestly, because I think the potential, like the quality of startups that I'm seeing now over the last couple of years, and to be honest, it's always happened, right? Periods of adversity have always spurred great companies, right? The financial crisis of 2000, you know, 8, we saw the likes of, you know, Uber, Airbnb come out of that. Now this, right? We are some of the next, you know, Decacons are being born today. And I think hopefully a couple of them would be the ones that I am now working with. So
No, absolutely. I think that's lovely to hear and goes to show the hunger that the founders have, right? I think it's very special, that energy, and the way you've gone about speaking with the journey with Swiggy and how you want to give back to the current founders who are building companies of tomorrow. It's just wonderful. Thank you so much, Ankit, for being your candid self and sharing your learning so kindly with us. I think I've definitely learned a lot through this conversation, with multiple things about the restaurant business, about the dine out journey, and about, you know, resilience as a founder and just growing through that journey. I hope you enjoyed it, and I'm sure everyone listening in will take back something.
No, thank you so much, Raj. It was a pleasure to be here, and thanks a lot for having me.
Awesome. With that, we come to the end of this conversation. Thank you so much for tuning into the episode. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're finding value with the podcast, do follow it on the audio streaming platform of your choice, drop in a review, and subscribe to our WhatsApp newsletter to get all the updates directly on your inbox. Thanks again. I will see you next week for another episode. Till then, I hope you recall. If you never try, you'll never know. Stay tuned and keep building.